This is Richly Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and the 2020 General Assembly session is underway. And besides legislative news, I understand there is a little bit of gaming industry news out there. And for all that, we turn to Ed Feigenbaum. He is the creator and the editor of Indiana Legislative Insight and the Indiana Gaming Insight. I get that one right all the time. It's just the legislative title I seem to mess up, Ed, and I apologize for that. In any case, he's the guy that created them, and Hannah New Service has them out there now. And Happy New Year to you, Ed Feigenbaum.
Well, thank you, Chris, and to you as well. And just to mention, we have a third newsletter as well that we've been publishing since 1997, Indiana Education Insight.
Oh, that's right.
We're considering adding a new newsletter to cover all the trauma in the British royal family now too.
Well, you may have to get your royals reporter established in London, and you'll be in good shape to be sure. You just have to get all the connections made to that to be sure. Well, speaking of connections overseas, let's look at connections here in Northwest Indiana and the rest of the state, for that matter, too. If you had the time to be able to spend on describing it, how would you characterize at least the way this 2020 General Assembly session is going now that we're in our second full week as we speak on Monday?
Well, I think they're really going at the speed of sound. It's very interesting. We're compressing essentially, you know, compressing about 4 months worth of work into a period of about 10 weeks here. We're going to be out by March 11th. And there's a lot of work to do, even though it seems like we did all the heavy lifting, you know, last year, particularly obviously with the gaming bill and the budget. But there's a lot of little things that need to be done this session. There's also a lot of things that the governor's got on his agenda, lawmakers have on their individual and collective caucus agendas, and it's going to be a very busy session. And they started out last week, literally from day one, with committee meetings back last Monday on the 6th, starting out with some substantive legislation, as well as some of the things that are just kind of courtesy hearings for other members and things like that, and constituency groups and all. But they are really moving very quickly compared to most sessions, and I think that's the key takeaway so far.
Do you get the impression that last week as the session started, even though it had been mentioned, I guess, even before the session officially started with some of the news conferences that were held as agendas were announced and things like that from the Republicans and the Democrats in both House and Senate, that we got an idea at least last week what areas were going to be taken up, and then we got some action, I guess, with measures that went through, I guess, last week on what measures were not going to be taken up. That is, we found out that the Republican-controlled Indiana House and Senate were not going to take up matters to be able to shift some budget money around, some newly found budget money, I should say, to go into education and in particular into teachers' races.
Yeah, although a lot of that is posturing, you know, obviously there were some laying out of priorities on both sides, and the Democrats in both the House and the Senate were not pleased with some of the Republican education priorities. But I think you may see a little bit of a change depending upon what the governor says in his State of the State address tomorrow evening. I think the governor is starting to loosen up his thinking on some of the education funding. And the Republicans in the House in particular, you know, laid down the law on some of the spending of the surplus money and some of the money from the toll road lease renegotiation that the governor wanted to spend on one-time capital projects. The House Republicans are a lot more interested in putting money toward one-time capital expenditures for higher ed than the governor had indicated. And the Republicans are not interested in spending $50 million on a swine barn at the state fairground or funding it with cash. I think that's something that they will end up saying, hey, fairgrounds, if you want to do that, the state fair commission is going to have to do that with bonding authority. But you know, there's a lot going on, even though we don't have a gaming bill of sorts coming up this year. There are a couple of little, you know, minor gaming bills, and one thing that everybody in the region should be paying attention to is legislation that's been authored by a couple of Wabash Valley legislators, Republican Alan Morrison and Democrat Tanya Paff, that would change the hold harmless requirements that were in the omnibus gaming bill that passed last year.
What kind of changes did they want to make that might have an impact on us up here? That's based back on that omnibus bill from last year.
Right. They just simply want to do away with the hold harmless money that would go mm-hmm. to, that would flow to Hammond, East Chicago, and Michigan City from the new Gary Casino, as well as some of the payments that would have to be made by the new Vigo County Casino to Evansville and Terre Haute. There may be some support for that outside the region. You know, obviously, Speaker-elect Todd Houston was not enamored with the hold harmless issue. That was the reason that he voted against his own legislation last year, because that was kept in there. But then you look at the reason why it was kept in there in conference last year, and you realize it was there because it was required to pass the bill. But there are also some other legislators from out of state. Representative Randy Fry from Greensburg is very concerned about how that legislation treated some of the money that flowed from Dearborn County to some of the surrounding counties. And I think, you know, you can pick up some of the support that you're looking for from Southeast Indiana. And all of a sudden, it becomes something that I think you're going to want to keep your eye on.
One of the other bills, which, in fact, I even know is up as we speak before the House Judiciary Committee for a hearing, is a measure that would have a good deal of impact on residents here in Northwest Indiana, particularly those who live along Lake Michigan. House Bill 1031, which is sponsored by a man who's, I would have to say, is in a landlocked area, that's Elkhart, is in turn would want to make some changes that might even cause the throwing out of a very important Indiana Supreme Court ruling from last year about Lake Michigan shoreline. This is an interesting measure, and are we finding that this is one that has got a lot of attention in Indianapolis?
No, and it seems like on most of these local-type matters, lawmakers are very reluctant to intervene unless they see that there's a real potential for this to affect other parts of the state. And, you know, in this particular case, that's not looking like it's going to happen. And if another example of that is the lawmakers in Hamilton County are kind of all up in a roar because of their mayors about the way that the local taxes are distributed. And according to the current formula, the city of Fishers, because mm-hmm. it used to be a town, is actually disadvantaged by the way that those tax dollars flow. And the mayor of Fishers says, hey, look, you know, we can fund our entire fire department if you just change the way to make it more equitable and the way that everybody else does it. But legislators are reluctant to intervene until there's a local agreement, until the locals come to you know, some sort of mind frame that they're going to all agree to. And you know, that's proven kind of difficult. So I think that what the legislature will probably do is say, hey, look, you know, this really looks like a local issue. Let's try and address this via ordinances, and you know, we can litigate it if we have to, but it's not something that necessarily should be on our agenda. Mm-hmm. Then again, you have a lot of newer legislators, those that were elected since about 2010, the last decade, and you know, many of those have a more libertarian viewpoint and don't think that the state should be at all involved, or the local government should be at all involved in regulating, you know, who gets to do what with their property. So, you know, there's that element of that as well that can come into play.
I get the impression that on this House Bill 1031, the one that is up for review before the House Judiciary Committee, is really up before the committee, I guess, just to open up the discussion that this probably not, as you say, not likely to make it through the sessions, through the houses, we should say, or the House or the Senate, in particular the chambers, but in turn will at least spark some conversation in Indianapolis.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's the way that everything does start. You know, you tend not to see big pieces of legislation or big policy changes pass in their first year or even second year. And then, you know, finally by the third year, you get people say, hey, you know, we've only heard about this before. Maybe we ought to start paying some attention to it. And by the fourth year, it's, oh, well, let's get this off the table. I thought we had already dealt with this, and they passed something. You know, that's the life cycle of legislation in Indianapolis.
Are there any other measures that we haven't mentioned that you're aware of, or topics at least, that lawmakers are taking up in this short session?
Yeah, there's one real interesting bill, Senate Bill 14, that's authored by Senator Mike Young, and and authored as well by the President Pro Tem of the Senate, Republican Rod Bray from Martinsville, and by the Democratic Senate leader, Tim Lannon of Anderson, that has as its one co-author, Senator Karen Tallien from Portage or Ogden Dunes, wherever you want to say she's from, that would essentially put a moratorium of sorts on any kind of significant criminal justice changes, changes in sentencing laws, changes in making something a crime. And we saw a few years ago that the legislators came in after many years of study and revamped the criminal code. And they did this because they felt that, you know, a lot of crimes were essentially misclassified, you know, under current kinds of social mores, you know, things for very small quantities of drugs like marijuana and other kinds of minor crimes. And so they also were hearing from their local officials that these local jails were being overcrowded by these people with longer sentences who shouldn't even be there. You know, we passed some expungement measures. We also passed some laws that lowered the criminal classification on some of these things. And then we kept tweaking things for the next 3 years. It was like, oh, well, we forgot about this, or this needs to be a crime, that needs to be a crime. We need to do this, we need to do that. And all of a sudden, the local jails started getting filled up again. They also started getting filled up as some state or what would have been state-level prisoners on higher sentences were reclassified, and that reclassification moved them back into local jails. So what the young Bray-Lannon-Tallien bill would do is to say, okay, anytime we're going to change any of these laws now, it has to go through a full review by the Interim Study Committee on, Courts and Corrections and Criminal Code, I think is the actual title. And that way we can look at these things outside the white heat of a legislative session and determine, you know, what's happened in the past, whether the changes that we've made in the past are doing what we intended them to do, and then how would this particular change that's being proposed fit in with that? Would that meet our longer-term, broader kinds of things that we're looking for, things that we want to achieve, and that they really couldn't be considered for the first time and passed in one session? Now, there's a little bit of pushback on that idea. You know, obviously there's an exemption for things that involve the exigent circumstances or emergencies, but people are really being urged that they should take that particular provision very seriously, and that, you know, it's not going to be kind of honored in the breach like, you know, most legislation seems to be. But there's a little bit of pushback from some senators on this who feel that this is a way for leadership, and not just Republican leadership, but leadership in a more generic sense, Democrats and the Republicans and the folks that are in charge on both sides, can better control the process and take some of the responsibility away from the rank and file legislators. So that's an interesting one to keep an eye on. I know that obviously, you know, changes in criminal code, you know, very important to people in the region. You know, there's some talk in Lake County about prosecutors exercising a little bit more discretion on small amounts of marijuana, like we did in Marion County. And there's also some talk legislatively about decriminalizing marijuana, although that's not going to get very far in spite of what Senator Tallien keeps trying to push. But this may be kind of a backdoor to do a lot of things that people in the region want to do, and it may see that or keep them from getting some of the things that they may want. So that's another bill to kind of keep an eye on.
Now, we only have about a couple of minutes left here. I've got to at least find out the latest here as far as the gaming issues are concerned. I know that the report just came out, I guess, on Friday from the Indiana Gaming Commission on how the year-end revenues totals turned out from the casinos. How did we do up in Northwest Indiana? And was sports gaming part of the any good amount of money that came in?
Well, you know, it's one of those, it was the worst of times, it was the best of times kinds of things. You know, it was the lowest annual win for the state since 2002. It was the first annual decline that the state has seen since 2015, and it was the largest annual decline since 2014. if you look at Northwest Indiana, all of the casinos were down year over year, except for Michigan City. You might want to say that they can explain the Michigan City lack of negative performance. They had about a 1.77% increase. The lack of any kind of negative performance like the others may be simply a matter of comparison. The Native American Casino opened last year in South Bend, and that's the casino that Blue Chip has been competing against most closely. And after that first year, you know, things are changing a little bit. So that may explain that away. But, you know, Northwest Indiana was not alone. There were nine casinos statewide that recorded annual declines, and only two that recorded annual growth, although both casinos also recorded annual growth. So it was not a great year. But then you talked about sports betting, and there really was kind of a turnaround for some of the boats, in particular Horseshoe Casino Hammond, in the second half. And it wasn't just because of sports wagering, but if you look at the first couple of months, you know, even before we had sports wagering in the last half of the year, Horseshoe really turned things around, and they recorded a year-over-year win in five of the last 6 months of 2020, when it had declined in five of the 6 months in the first half of the year. So something's changing there and changing for the positive. And some of that is obviously in the last 3 months due to sports wagering. And we have seen, not just anecdotally now, but seen in terms of real numbers, that attendance has increased at the Northwest Indiana casinos and the casinos in Southeast Indiana closer to large cities like Caesars Southern Indiana and Louisville, and the Hollywood Casino in Lawrenceburg and Cincinnati. People are coming across the river to wager at those two casinos. They're coming across the Skyway to wager in Northwest Indiana at the retail facilities, and that has proven to be a boost to the table game revenue in particular at the casinos. It seems like the casinos are getting some new players, they're getting some reactivated players, and they're finding that a new demographic is realizing that, hey, there are some casinos here and we can have fun, you know, at these casinos. The table games are a little bit more interactive than, you know, slot machine offerings, obviously, and that's what the younger demographic likes. And the food and beverage options apparently are appealing to the new patrons, because at least at Horseshoe Casino Hammond, food and beverage dollars have gone up considerably since sports wagering began.
That's good to hear. It's good to hear. Well, I hope, Ed, we'll have a chance to bring you back on here before the end of the month here as we get near to the end of the legislative session to talk about some of the issues as they've shaped up in the weeks ahead. And we thank you very much for being with us today.
Legislating at the speed of sound. Thanks for having me, Chris.
Thank you. Ed Feigenbaum is the editor-creator of Indiana Legislative Insight, Indiana Gaming Insight, Indiana Education Insight. We're going to talk about that folder in particular for the newsletters. And they're all coming from the HANA News Service. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. The Griffith Police Department is not unique in having social workers on its staff. Erica Rios tells us that she took advantage of some personal trauma to steer her life in that career direction, a career that she says is challenging and rewarding.
I think that what led me to social work was just life. I think most people in this profession, something led them to it, to want to help people. In my particular circumstance, I really think that helping people has always been something I was interested in doing, but particularly back in 2003, my first husband was killed in Iraq, and it was a really tough time in my life, and I think at that moment in time, it being the beginning of the war, and a lot of people really weren't sure what to do. It had been a long time since there were mass casualties and notifications. Mm-hmm. I kind of fell through a lot of the cracks, and so not having anyone to turn to really sparked my interest in being that person people turn to when they were experiencing a crisis in their life.
In particular, it drew you, I guess, to the law enforcement side, so to speak, and the fact that people that end up being involved one way or the other with the police oftentimes need some kind of help.
Absolutely, yeah, for sure. And I think because this is an interesting arena for people, you know, police officers, first responders in general. You know, they come across people in times of need and crisis. And it's hopefully been a good tool for them to be able to use someone like me or with this background, you know, in their work.
How did it seem to fit when you got involved working here in particular with the Griffith Police Department as to how you fit into the overall organization of the police department? Because police departments are always be known for having social workers, even though they are officers end up being social workers, I guess, on the spot, don't they?
Sure, absolutely. They're always referring people to services and things that they need, making suggestions and giving guidance. So how I fit here, you know, it just all kind of seems to fit together when officers are out doing their work and they come across someone that maybe has a need that is a little bit more intense or has a need that isn't as basic as, you know, maybe I need a little help with food or I need a little help with housing or maybe I just need somebody to talk to. You know, a lot of people are experiencing mental health issues and it's just not something that they're totally equipped with dealing with. And so having a professional with a mental health background is really helpful.
Are you finding that that's what many of the opportunities that you have to talk to people out there, that maybe the officers have asked for your assistance on the street, so to speak, or maybe during an investigation of some kind, that it's because there's a problem that they feel they can't quite handle, but they know they can get somebody some help?
Sure, absolutely. That is definitely one of them. There are several, but I think for the most part, when I'm engaging with officers on the road, it is definitely mental health issues, domestic violence, sometimes family issues. Mm-hmm. People lose their jobs and they need a little bit of extra help to get them through. And then, of course, on the backside of things, in the investigative portion of it, I'm definitely not a detective, but I assist in any way that I can to try to help the people who are involved with our detective bureau get the help that they need.
Do you think maybe in that particular case, maybe one of the regular investigators on the force might have been talking to people and he's got some information, but maybe want to get a little bit more questions out from somebody they've talked to, and perhaps they turn to you to help come up with some ways to help them?
I think so. You know, it's always better to have two ideas or three ideas or the perspective of somebody who doesn't have a law enforcement background. So,
what seems to be the best way that you've been able to work with the officers here with the Griffith Police Department? Because it's not a big department, but it's in a community that's very diverse, and I guess they have their share of problems, of wide-ranging problems, I would imagine.
Sure. So I think that the way that I work with them, so I have a background with the Department of Child Services. I'm very familiar with having the social work background and the DCS background, very familiar with the area. I grew up here. I actually grew up in Griffith. So it's helpful for me to know the area, know the demographic, and actually know a lot of the families that have been here for generations. Mm-hmm. It's been very helpful to have the background through the state and working through DCS, understanding the court systems, understanding what is actually out there for families who have needs, and especially kids. Kids are often forgotten sometimes, not just in the world of law enforcement, but in the school arena. I think sometimes people forget that there are children involved in situations, and sometimes they're overlooked. So it's been really good for me to be able to put all of my experience to work, and then with this degree and being able to, really show what I can do.
You mentioned young people. Are there times on occasion that the Griffith Public Schools ask for you to help them out? They may have, of course, specialists or people they turn to on a regular basis, but sometimes they maybe need a little extra help, and do they turn to you even though you're with the police department?
Well, and so it's funny that you would ask that. I'm actually contracted by the schools to work there 50% of the time. So I spend three of my work days during the school year, three of my work days during the week at the school. And they certainly do use that knowledge base that I have. So I try to help bridge the gap between outside communities and agencies and the school, improving relationships and better outcomes for our kids.
Give us just an example of a situation where you may be called in. Maybe it's a case where an officer is having some problems out there. Mm-hmm. He's dealing with somebody at an apartment complex, of which there are several in Griffith. Mm-hmm. And you may have some problems, they may have some problems with somebody. And then there's some youngsters that are involved in the mix as well, too. Give us an idea of what sorts of things that you, when you get into a situation and they're asked for help, do you find that you have to kind of start first to look at and what steps you tend to take and whatever help you can give?
So I think in a situation like you mentioned, you're going into a situation with a family who has come into the scope of law enforcement for one reason or another. whatever that may be. Because I have access to both the systems and the police department on the law side and at the school, I can kind of check out with those kids, you know, what's going on at school, what's going on at home. It's easier to really identify what a problem can be from a holistic perspective and not just from law enforcement or just from school or just from social work. So I try to piece all those things together like a puzzle to give the family a better picture of what's going on and what we can possibly do to help them. Yeah.
Now, even though you have been involved in many, many cases of certain types, are there any other that you've been able to follow through on that have come up with some very positive and satisfying results?
Yes. In fact, I follow up on quite a few things. And we have one example that I could think of was a gal here in town who was having some domestic violence issues. And we were able to piece together some family members and things that she needed and to get her just out of the situation that she was in and to live with relatives far away. We were able to get her to a safe place very quickly. We were able to put that family piece back in with them. Residents here in town who have come across maybe needing some income or rent assistance, things like that. Something's falling down around them. They're not really sure where to go to get the help and have followed up with people saying, hey, you know, do you remember me? You know, I needed help with my basement that flooded back when the pipes burst in January. Things are going really great. And as you mentioned before, it's a small town. A lot of people know each other, go to church together, work together, their kids go to school together. And so working in the town where I grew up, people grab me quite frequently when I'm out doing things and saying, hey, you helped my so-and-so do this, or you helped my friend do that. You know, so it's really kind of cool to see that.
Are there any ideas or areas that maybe you've kind of conferred with Chief Mance and his other senior officers about that you would like to, if you're not already involved in, that you might like to be involved in over time?
You know, truthfully, there are two things that I really would like to start doing that I haven't had the chance to do because I seem to be busy, a lot busier than I ever imagined I would be. Mm-hmm. One is to develop a wellness or peer support program for our law enforcement officers, which would include current officers, former officers, and retired officers. That community really just, they need the support of each other. And I think in the climate of law enforcement, as what we're seeing across the spectrum with suicide and things of that nature, it's better to get ahead of the problem before it starts or before it presents itself. And the second thing is I would really like to start providing more community trainings, whatever that looks like. Faith-based community is open to having me come and do training such as suicide prevention, child protection training, discussing child abuse and neglect, discussing human trafficking, you know, things that do touch our lives, but not everybody really either knows about or wants to talk about. So raising awareness to be able to prevent things from happening is a passion of mine.
Erica, thank you very much for explaining what your job as the social worker for the Griffith Police Department is all about, and I hope that things go well, not only for you, but for the rest of the department into the new year.
Thank you.
Erica Rios is a social worker with the Griffith Police Department. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. We have talked to a number of the people here in Northwest Indiana who are interested in succeeding Congressman Pete Visklosky in Congress in Washington, D.C., and we have another here in the studio to talk about his candidacy. Ryan Farrar is with us. Ryan, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, take a moment, talk about yourself, your interest being a native of the region, and in particular, the fact that you're not a complete political newcomer. You have run for public office before. And what did that experience, along with everything else that you've experienced in your neighborhood, so to speak, in South Lake County, got you interested in now deciding to run for Congress?
Yeah, so I'm 39 years old. I've effectively I say I've lived in the first district my whole life. That's technically not true at the moment because the lines were redrawn after the last census. I'm actually about a mile outside, but you know, I've been, like I said, I was born, my parents met in East Gary, and lived my whole life in this culture and community. So even though I'm on the outside of the boundary, I'm totally eligible to run for this seat. It's you know, I've been voting for Pete Visklosky since I was 18, so I've always kind of dreamed of replacing him. But yeah, I ran for state Senate in 2018. It was a really hard race. If you know state Senate District 6, which does cover the south half of Lake County, it's very Republican. And I was actually very proud of the results, even though we didn't win. You know, I got almost 19,000 votes, about 37% of the vote. It may not sound like huge returns, but if you look at the history of Democrats running in that district, it's the best returns ever a Democrat has ever had running there. So
Did that opportunity and running for state senate, even though you didn't win the race, did that give you at least the idea that maybe you could go on for bigger and better things?
Absolutely. You know, it was, in a way, I kind of look at that as it was almost a test run, like a learning experience. And I learned so much that I'm already using as I've launched this campaign. I've made a lot of connections, just learned how to do things. You know, little things I overlooked back then, like just putting out a press release and making all those proper contacts. That was a rough transition back then because I was still working for the state. You know, I worked for the Department of Child Services. And because of some of my cases kind of running long, I didn't want to back out of that position before I started campaigning, but I needed to start campaigning. So I kind of got a late start on that. So I've learned those lessons, and I haven't fallen into those same kind of pitfalls this time around.
In planning for this campaign, which is, it was going to be a pretty strenuous one, you've got three counties to cover, basically Lake and Border and LaPorte, make up the first congressional district. You focused in, I guess, not only on the issues that all the other candidates have mentioned so far, but you bring up one big important issue that hasn't been brought up that you feel should be addressed as a progressive Democrat, and that's the issue of campaign reform. What got you first to think about that idea, and how do you think that is going to fit into the campaign that you're going to be running for now, going up to the primary election?
Yeah, it's actually been something that has been on my radar for a long time. You know, the thing that first drew me into politics was as a young man experiencing the 2000 election, feeling like democracy was under attack, you know, seeing somebody get elected who didn't get the most votes at the presidential level. That kind of disturbed me. So, you know, I was just working in a factory then as a young man, and I actually got laid off. My factory moved south of the border, largely because of the NAFTA trade agreement. So that presented an opportunity for me to go to college. I majored in political science, and I was always looking for what's the thing that can fix politics? What's the thing that's going to make representatives work for the people more and reflect our interests? And it just became increasingly obvious to me that the problem is the corrupting influence of money. You know, we talked a lot in the last election about foreign campaign interference. Election interference. And of course, that's a serious issue as well. But under our Citizens United, we allow pretty much any corporation, any billionaire to have unlimited influence. You know, they can launch these super PACs, they can funnel millions, hundreds of millions of dollars in some cases into these super PACs. And it's just an unfair amount of speech that they get. So, and moreover, when you look at how much money the candidates themselves get from corporations, it's really disturbing. What I like to say is, if we're going to reform climate change, our healthcare system, criminal justice system, we can't have candidates that are getting more money from the fossil fuel industry, from private prisons, from the healthcare and the insurance industry, because when they're getting more money from those entities than they get in a congressional salary, well, who are they really working for? So that's something that, you know, I'd love to go to Washington and bring that fight there. Obviously, that's the ultimate goal. But even if I can't do that, I'm going to use this election, this campaign, to bring awareness to this issue. So to me, that, you know, it makes me feel like I'm fighting the good fight. Even if I don't get to go fight the fight in Washington, I'm going to keep pushing for transparency and accountability in this campaign.
Okay. Let's talk about some of the issues that have been brought up, and some of them are related to what you've just mentioned about the importance to look into serious campaign reform. And some are related in a way because you've had experiences personally here in Northwest Indiana. One in particular is immigration, the immigration issue that is foremost to many people in Northwest Indiana. And you were able to fight it in a way back in 2018 when the GEO Group was very interested in locating a facility here in Northwest Indiana. And tell us about that and what you learned from that experience.
Yeah, it was a weird coincidence. You know, I was already running. I had just won the primary in the contest. And almost the very next day, actually it was that evening, the evening of the primary, I was contacted by some allies in Northwest Indiana, a lot of the people that were instrumental in keeping GEO Group out of the northern part of Lake County about a proposal for Newton County, which, like I said, I live at the very northern edge of Newton County. So I looked into it, and by coincidence, I found that there was a recent rezoning, which I was well aware of because it was within a few hundred feet or yards of my house. So it looked like that spot was being primed for the potential detention center, and I just felt like action needed to be taken. So I worked with a lot of allies up this way. I know a lot of people, especially running for office, they try to distance themselves from activist groups, but I was looking for all the help I can get. So I talked to people within Northwest Indiana Resistance, Black Lives Matter, anybody who was willing to give me advice and assistance in how to fight this thing. And we developed a strategy to pressure the public officials, let them know we didn't want it, let them know we needed some assurances that it wasn't going to happen. And they were very resistant because if you're running a county, you realize having something like that in your county, it is going to generate revenue. And, you know, a lot of our public officials down there are more concerned with Kentland than they are Roselawn. So it was a big fight, but we kept the pressure on. We kept attending commissioners' meetings, letting them know how we felt. And in time, I think we made the issue toxic enough for them that they gave in, and they sent a letter to Geo Group and basically told them, you know, we're not going to support you coming to Newton County. And I consider that a huge accomplishment.
What are your thoughts about the issue of economic development? And you look at it too, I understand, from a pro-labor point of view, rather than just simply building more opportunities for more businesses and industries in Northwest Indiana.
Yeah. The way I look at it, you know, and I agree with, there does need to be a raise of the minimum wage. I would argue that it's not necessarily it needs to be 15. I think we need a market-based minimum wage that is reflective of economic factors, GDP, et cetera, so we can have the right minimum wage in the right area, because all 50 states have different factors going on in that regard. But overall, I think the true key to increasing wages for more prosperity for the middle and the lower working class is union rights. You know, since the 1980s, union rights have been getting attacked and eroded. You know, I see no reason that there should be such a thing as right to work laws. They really only exist to allow people to be able to opt out of paying their union membership, which weakens the strength of the union. And in time, that union gets so weak that they just get run over when it comes time to do the collective bargaining. And another thing I see is, you know, CEO pay often being so outrageously high. And I think that the membership, the workers of a company, ought to have a say themselves in how much the people at the top of their corporation make. I mean, how much more valuable than the rank and file are they? So, you know, that's money that should perhaps be put into profit sharing, perhaps investment in the company. So these are just, you know, the very tip of the iceberg in terms of trying to get more wages in the pockets of the people, which is ultimately what's really going to turn the economy around. So when people have that expendable income, that's when you see a real economic boom.
I know that even though it's not a key campaign plank for you, the environment is important to you, and you've experienced that in your own neighborhood, I understand. Is that particularly close experience what has gotten you into adding that in your thought of running for Congress?
To some degree, you know, it's another one of those things that almost happened by chance. You know, 6 or 7 years ago, I was going through a career change, and sort of just in a mode of trying to find myself, I became an outdoorsman for a while. You know, I was able to just take some time and focus on fishing. And I got so into fishing, I was virtually a climate scientist, because I wasn't just doing it to do it. Like, I wanted the best experience as possible. I was studying water conditions, weather conditions, following moon phases, and being out in the outdoors almost every day. So it really gave me a chance to connect with nature, but also to observe what was happening. And just seeing, you know, our streams and rivers were just not as healthy as I thought they would be. You know, a lot of times the conditions should have been great for fishing, and fish just wouldn't be biting. And you see, you know, a lot of contamination, pollution, a lot of it coming from a field runoff, quite frankly. But it all, you know, it all really brought me back around to the science of climate change, which at the time, you know, under the Obama administration, we kind of felt like we were going to get it right. You know, when you look at all the things we've accomplished in terms of technology in this country, you would think that there would be a priority, you know, to keeping the planet healthy. But now it looks like we're just not headed in the right direction. So, you know, I have a lot of ideas for that as well. I was just thinking last night just in terms of cars. You know, we burn a lot of gas. What can we do about it? Well, we have electric cars. The technology is already there. But, you know, I think a big part of the problem is they're not appealing to the consumers with the vehicles. You know, a lot of people like to drive SUVs. They like to drive trucks. So when it comes time to buy a new vehicle, there's not a good electric option on the market. So I like to think that, you know, if I'm in Congress, I can fight to put some incentives for the car industry to start producing the vehicles that people might want to switch over to electric so that, you know, I think, you know, if we do this right, that within 10 years, people who, you know, they have their basic commuter vehicles, they could replace those vehicles when they look for a new vehicle with an electric version and maybe get anywhere from 50 to 75% of the gas-powered vehicles replaced with electric ones. Now, that wouldn't in itself solve climate change. You know, a lot more has to be done, but it's something.
Now, you've got your campaign started here as we wrap up 2019. You're looking to 2020, and that's, of course, going to be the real work. You'll have until the elections in May to get out there and visit Northwest Indiana. Any thoughts about how you're going to get your campaign underway as the new year gets underway, and in turn, how you're going to keep it as strong as you can up until Election Day?
Yeah, for me, I've decided I'm going to really, really push social media. I'm on pretty much every platform right now. I got a Facebook, I got a Twitter, Instagram, Tumblr. Whatever I can do to bring some eyeballs onto the campaign, I'm going to do. Obviously got a lot of appearances already booked. There's going to be a town hall sponsored by Indivisible that's going to be taking place on the 16th at the Maryville Lake County Public Library.
That's right.
And then just a couple days later, the Porter and Lake Young Democrats are sponsoring the first debate of the primary season at the same public library there in Maryville. So I'm really excited, especially for the debate, to be able to just stand toe-to-toe with all the other candidates on stage and, you know, show the difference between us. You know, right now I think a lot of us are saying similar things. You know, I'm trying to stand out and really put campaign finance reform forward because I believe that's the issue that obstructs all other issues. But it seems like generally you hear the Democrats talk and it's like, yeah, we want to get you health care. We want to fight climate change and we're pro-union. And so being able to stand toe-to-toe and we're like really dig in and point out our differences is something I think is going to be huge for the voters.
Well, Ryan, sounds like you have quite a lot of work ahead, and we appreciate you spending time and talking about your campaign as it's getting underway now, and I hope to have a chance to talk with you and catch you on some of these other campaign stops in the weeks and the months ahead before the May primary elections. Thank you for joining us today.
If I could make one last little plug, I'm going to be putting on what I'm calling a Very Vote for Our Christmas special. It's going to go up on my social media sometime tomorrow. And what I'm going to be doing is sitting down with my acoustic guitar. So I'm also a musician. I'm going to play some Christmas songs. It's going to be my way of just wishing everyone a Merry Christmas and saying thank you to everybody who's been supporting my campaign. And I think it's just a fun way. Hopefully I can get some new eyeballs on our campaign. So I'm really looking forward to that. But thanks for having me.
Ryan, thank you very much for being with us today. We appreciate it. Ryan Farrar is one of the latest candidates running for Congress as Pete Viscoski has chosen not to run for another term of office. And there's quite a field already developing for the May primary election on the Democratic Party. And that conversation from late last month before Christmas. And Ryan's not the latest person to file for the Democratic nomination. Melissa Borum of Gary and Tony Daggett Sr. of Hammond are also intending to file as Democratic candidates. And on the Republican side, Spencer Lemons of Hobart and William F. Bill Powers have also decided to run. The director of the Indiana Department of Revenues decided to challenge embattled State Attorney General Curtis Hill in his bid to seek the Republican nomination for the office. Adam Krupp told the Journal-Gazette in Fort Wayne that he would resign as the Department of Revenues head at the end of January to run full-time for Attorney General. And he has been a practicing lawyer in the private sector in the past, experience that Krupp says will make him right for the job.
The cases that I've worked on and the skills that we developed were everything from bankruptcy to breach of contract to antitrust investigations.
He will be one of three Republicans who are vying for the GOP nomination to run for Attorney General in November. The December Ag Economy Barometer shows farmers are less confident these days about current conditions, but more optimistic looking into the future.
The national survey asks 400 agriculture producers a range of questions each month, from financial plans to perspectives on current economic issues, including a trade war with China. Report co-author Jim Mintert says the December responses showed no overall shift in sentiment.
But there was a shift within the index, and that was really this idea that people were less confident about their current situation on their farming operation and the ag economy, but actually a touch more confident about the future.
Mintert says producers are showing confidence that a trade deal with China will come soon. But if another negotiation falls through, that could affect January survey responses. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
With an eye on the arts, here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts are Matt Franklin and Tony Santucci, who are the executive producer and producer, respectively, of Eye on the Arts TV version that I used to host once upon a time. And welcome, gentlemen. You came all the way downstairs from your offices and Matt down the hall.
Rough commute this morning.
I know. I mean, how was the traffic in the hallway? So what is going on? It's been about, what, 3 years now since Eye on the Arts has expanded and become half-hour shows?
We're about in March, we'll be launching our fifth season, actually.
Oh, already?
Yeah,
time
yeah.
Flies, sorry.
No, that's okay. It flew for us, too. So,
yeah.
Yeah, fifth season. People may remember it was a video segment on our news back in the day, quite similar to what you do on the radio right now.
Yes.
And we expanded it to a half-hour show that features four or five artists in five-minute segments or so. And, yeah, so that's where we're at now.
I will have you know that I was recently a guest in the home of a very, very, very prominent art collector who happens to live in Northwest Indiana. Sort of uncharacteristically, and she just couldn't stop gushing about Eye on the Arts, those segments that you do.
Well, I think that's when you did the conversation in the studio as part of the Friday night newscast.
Yeah,
it was something where I think it really connected with a certain part of the community, and I always saw this as an opportunity to leverage what we built from that initial conversation out into the community, because Lakeshore is here to connect with people all across the region, not only the, you know, three counties of Northwest Indiana, but we strive to hit, you know, outside areas.
Mm-hmm.
And Eye on the Arts was an opportunity to connect with people, but to show instead of telling.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Tony and his team's great work of telling these stories in the artist or the artistic organization's voice has really allowed us to connect with viewers like you're talking
yeah.
about in a way that we couldn't get along with just a conversation.
Yeah, totally. It humanizes it more.
Yeah, and I think there was some opportunities. I always said, you know, one of the great things about art is it can mean different things to different people.
Mm-hmm.
And I was always surprised by the stories of, you know, how art could be, you know, creative placemaking,
mm-hmm.
An economic engine for a community. I mean, look at what Miller Beach is doing mm-hmm. around the arts, and even Valparaiso has mm-hmm. really embraced the arts.
Mm-hmm.
Chesterton's another community, Crown Point. So there's opportunities to share those stories with people and give them that idea that, wow, I never looked at it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, you know, we have some other kind of recurring themes that I like to say, you know, art is an educational tool for lifelong learning and the rehabilitative power of art, you know, with like our friends at Frontline. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, you hear some of these stories and how art really can take some people to places they never expected.
Well, Tony, also, I think the variety of arts providers and artists that you've featured has a lot of appeal.
Yeah.
The tattoo parlor and the milliner in Michigan City.
Right, yeah. We try to be as diverse as we can, and not only in the types of arts but the types of artists. Some of them are artists in the fact and that's how they make their living, and some of them are more hobbyists, but they still have a passion for what they do.
Right.
You know, like you mentioned, we've done tattoo artists, we've done lots of music and theater, even things like fight choreography, which is kind of, you know, maybe you have to squint at it a little bit to see that it's art, but once you start talking to those people, it's definitely art. The way they their passion and the effort that they put into it. You know, it's art can be so many things, and there's, and you know just as well as we do, there's so many talented people in the area.
More and more all the time.
And it's great to give them an opportunity to be seen, because the art community, they tend to be a little insular, I think. And hopefully we have a chance to broaden what that is. And what we found is when we go out and shoot a story about an artist, they probably know a half a dozen artists or a dozen artists, and that they might be in totally different fields. So they have their communities. We hope we can maybe show all those communities and make it a larger community.
And what's coming up with Eye on the Arts in the near future?
So our new season, our fifth season, will launch March 18th, which is a Wednesday, at 7 p.m. And then we'll have an episode every week for 6 weeks on Wednesday at 7 p.m. And that will include – we're in the production of that right now. We're probably halfway through. We have Taiko drums, which is kind of an old – Japanese tradition of drumming you might be familiar with, where they just kind of have these massive drums that they hit with these mallets and things. We're looking to expand to a music segment. So if there's any artists out there, musicians with original works they want to have us cover, that'd be great. You can send any ideas to art@lakeshorepublicmedia.org. We're always looking for ideas. We only know what we know, so
if we can branch out. And we like to embrace the community to offer, you know, we really try to embrace community engagement. So let us know more of the art that you want to see, or, you know, what your thoughts were about a particular segment that we've done. We love to have these things shared all across the planet.
And you can catch all the conversations of Eye on the Arts here on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us, and I hope you'll join us tomorrow.